Welcome to the A-Dub Club, a podcast about sci-fi, fantasy, technology, pop culture, the internet, and general nerdery. There are three things that are important to know. One, we occasionally use swear words, but try to stay in the range of PG-13, or at least the kind of R that cool parents are fine with. Two, we may talk spoilers. In this particular episode, we discuss the TV show Penny Dreadful, the movies I Am Legend, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, and Scream, the books Ender's Game and Frankenstein, and the video games Warcraft and World of Warcraft. So, be warned. Three, most importantly, the country with the most wins in the foreign language film category of the Oscars is Italy, with 14 wins. Now, with that all out of the way, welcome to the clubhouse. We have snacks. Welcome to the A-Dub Club. My name is Andrew Whipple.
I'm Alex Wade.
Never once will there be a third thing. Never once will I know what to say after we do that.
Third thing.
Never once. How's it going? How's it going, Oxway?
It's going good. I just moved. I got some space pictures on the wall because I wouldn't be A-Dub if I didn't have space pictures on my wall.
I don't think I have any space pictures on my wall. I do have a map of Disneyland. I do have posters that I got from Chicago's Comic-Con last year of Batgirl and D.Va from Overwatch. And Daenerys from Game of Thrones, but that poster refuses to stick on my wall for some reason and keeps falling.
These are all sufficiently A-Dublicious.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this week on the podcast known as the A-Dub Club, we are going to be diving into the dark, seedy underbelly of literature and geekdom and fandom and all of that fun stuff to answer the question, what makes monsters monsters?
What does make a monster monster? Yeah. So would you like to start?
We started thinking about this, or you started thinking about this, I guess, because you're watching the TV show Penny Dreadful.
Yeah.
Which is a fun show. I'd seen the first season a little couple years back. But it's an interesting show of sort of gothic and romance literature fan fiction. Victor Frankenstein fighting vampires while also hunting werewolves, while also there being a bunch of other assorted mix-em-ups.
Seances and devils and Frankenstein again.
So what was it about that show that sort of got you interested in the idea of monsters as a topic?
Yeah, I mean, I was watching it and there is this nature of the main characters of this duality of they're there for a purpose. There's no like good guys per se. There are the people who you're focusing on. And then there's like true evil in the show that is represented by literally Satan sometimes, or by evil monsters. And this just seemed like a very interesting, I don't know, kind of spectacle of tropes in fiction of we're going to take all these dreadful things and these scary horror stories and then kind of make a, expanded universe of creation of these things, you know? This is also, by the way, of horror movies. Like, I watched one of my first horror movies when I was like 10, maybe.
Which one was it?
It wasn't even a horror movie. It was a thriller. I Am Legend.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It has zombies in it or vampires or whatever. And it's just like jump scares. This, I wouldn't even qualify it as a horror movie, but it scared the bejesus out of me. I had nightmares for weeks. And since then, I was like, nope, I will never watch or see any horror movie fiction ever again. Lately, I've been trying to, you know, expand my life and do things that I haven't done before. And someone suggested to me that I watch Penny Dreadful. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go for it. And it hasn't given me nightmares, which is nice because it also has a lot of like poetry in it that's very like Victorian England as opposed to trying to necessarily instill terror in the audience.
This is entirely a sidebar, but I got very worried when you said, oh, it's not actually a horror movie, it's a thriller, because I get, as someone who personally loves horror movies and thinks they are amazing and fantastic, I get so mad that time and time again, basically, if a horror movie is good and like quote-unquote respectable people like it and it starts getting Oscar nominations and stuff like that, universally you find people crawling out of the woodwork to start calling it a thriller instead of a horror movie of like, no, oh. Get Out is actually a psychological thriller. Silence of the Lambs is actually a psychological thriller. The Exorcist is a religious thriller. It's like, no, dog, those are all horror movies.
Oh boy.
Get it straight. But anyway, that's maybe to sort of take a little bit of a step back, because I think there's a lot of really good stuff in that. Let's just think of some examples of monsters. If we have some examples of monsters and compare some examples of monsters to maybe non-monsters and see if there's like a taxonomy that comes across from that, and what sort of makes the monster monstrous.
I think within that, we should start at the beginning of like, where did monsters come from? I mean, monsters originally were just like when we were cavemen or nomadic people going across the continent, they were just like animals. Those were monsters. So there is a lion or there's a bear that has been terrorizing your tribe or whatever. And people would create stories about these things. And I mean, you look at it all throughout Native American culture, and I say that with the full knowledge that I know almost literally nothing about Native American culture, so I will butcher everything here.
If you are anthropologist that listens to this podcast, if one of the like four people that listens to this happens to be an anthropologist, then please email us in the awclub@gmail.com, thewclub@gmail.com.
We have four people? That's amazing.
Maybe. I think... let me check, continue talking about monsters while I check our stats.
Yeah. So I think from there, monsters kind of grew as our imaginations grew. And as we eventually started to conquer these other beasts, well, we said, okay, since man, I guess this is arrogant, but true, is, you know, the greatest creature to exist on this planet, that we are really probably our own biggest threat. So we started combining these stories of like, oh, bears, they're still pretty goddamn scary. So what if there was someone who could turn into a bear or maybe a wolf, like a werewolf? At least that's how in my mind, that's my logical conclusion of like where that would evolve to of like, what if there was someone who had the power, the strength, the speed, the pack mentality of a wolf, but had the intelligence and cunning of a human, wouldn't that be the most terrifying thing to come upon our people?
I definitely don't disagree with that idea of like, there's something in these monsters that is a way of personifying and wrapping your head in a narrative way around things that are outside of our control and pose a direct threat to us as people. And I think you can extend that to like natural disasters or even further along as like civilizations start to form and become things that we have to deal with of like, you know, foreign invaders and other things that can cause death and pestilence and danger.
Yeah. I mean, that was what for natural disasters specifically. I mean, this isn't really monsters, but people would create gods for those. That would be like Poseidon. He's the guy who's going to come around and terrorize us because he's angry that we didn't do X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. Yeah, I think thinking about like Greek gods and stuff like that is interesting because monsters are also a big part of a lot of mythological fiction. I'm not a... someone who has studied the history of mythology. I'm not a, you know, study comparative religion, blah, blah, blah. So who knows? But
pause. So I think we should have a statement where we say qualifying statements, where when we say qualifying statements, that just means we know there's a lot of wiggle room for whatever we're about to say. And instead of saying all those different possible wiggle rooms, we'll just cheat and say qualifying statements, which means we're probably maybe wrong or maybe we're fucking spot on.
I love it. Get out of jail free card for the fact that we don't do research or preparation for this show. That the rock and roll. All right. Well, in that case, qualifying statements, I guess, to say that in Greek mythology, it seems like a lot of these monsters come about as like challenges or trials or things that have to be overcome. Thinking about like Hercules fighting off the Kamara, or I don't know if he actually did that, qualifying statements, you know, Theseus with the Minotaur, the Medusa, the Sirens, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, to go down that of like of gods versus monsters per se, of what, there's not necessarily a very defined line in a lot of those cases, because there are a lot of those monsters that are the children of these gods. And what makes them a demigod versus a demon, basically, is what? Is how pure of heart they are? Is how grotesque they look?
I do think with some of these, there's an element of like, I mean, malice seems to be an element of it. Generally speaking, you don't, the ones that do good things, or primarily good things, don't tend to be monsters. Good things towards humans and towards the heroic characters of whatever we're falling through. So I guess, and maybe that's, that is admittedly one of the most obvious things in the world you could say about a monster, is a monster has to do bad things. But I do think that is one element that sort of separates.
I agree, but I think that's something, again, that's super subjective of like, imagine it's Lord of the Rings and Sauron took over the human race or enslaved the human race instead of the orcs. Qualifying statements, don't know shit about Lord of the Rings. And the orcs were the good guys who were like taking the ring to Mordor. And it's just a matter of perspective, right? Of like, these are the people who are trying to save their own lives, who are trying to expand their own empire per se. And it's just a matter of perspective of where the story plays from.
I think that that is another sort of way to step back on thinking about monsters, that, okay, one thing about monsters is that they have to be causing damage or causing harm or be some sort of danger, but that danger has to be, before you can define what that danger is, you have to have a frame for who are the, who's the perspective that you're using going forward in this story, whether it's a like actual narrative story in a book or a movie or a legend, or like the sort of broader meta story of the way you have your perspective about the world.
Yeah. But there's also that, that visual, right, of like a orc looks like a monster. If you showed someone a picture of an orc, you're like, evil, bad, gonna kill you, monster, right? Which brings me to one of my favorite sections of lore ever, which I'm not like thoroughly versed on.
Qualifying statements.
Qualifying statements. God damn it. That's the problem, is we just talk in qualifying statements. So
I know. Whatever. We'll find a balance. We'll find a balance. We should rename the podcast Qualifying Statements.
That's
oh, anyway.
Which brings me to one of my favorite sections of lore is Warcraft. In the original Warcraft, I don't think there was much of any lore. It was really just like, you have humans, you have orcs, they're fighting against each other. It's a RTS in the style of like StarCraft, you know, Age of Empires style game. And it's the good guys versus the monsters. Then as time goes on, more games come out, and then eventually like World of Warcraft, one of the, if no, not one of the biggest MMO ever created. And you get to like learn about the stories of the orcs, and it's just a fascinating story. Cause there's a character named Thrall, and that's the only good character from the orcs that I know of. And it tells like this story of like, they're this noble, proud race, they're a warrior race, sure, which is, you know, violent, but it's also like they have honor, they have a hardworking mentality. They're just hardworking Americans, you know, which is like hearing it from there. That was one of my favorite. There's a solo, like in Warcraft 3 Frozen Throne, there's a solo adventure where he plays Rexxar, and it's a story that's told of you, this half orc, and it's like how he's this great guy who's like trying to save something, whatever, he's the good guy, even though he looks like this monster. And that's kind of the constant duality for his character. It's like he's half human, half orc, and is you know, he's hated from both sides because he's a mutt and no one likes him.
So this is a question. Do orcs see themselves as monsters, Or, which is where I'm going with this, is that duality between hero and monster partially coming from the fact that he's part human, knows that humans see orcs as monsters, and so that's where he's like...
That's definitely it.
Okay. So, like, just random-ass orc totally would be like, yeah, orcs are great. Cool.
Well, I guess, yeah. I guess that's something... Yeah. Well, let's go, I guess, into the psyche of what makes a monster... a monster versus just like, I mean, there's obvious like looks and like that perspective of things, but like we call serial killers monsters because they're ugly, right?
Yeah. Well, I was curious about sort of eventually working my way towards that idea of like, there's a lot of different kinds of monsters, and some of them are like, what are the real life natural monsters? The, you know, angry, violent bear, the lion, the tornado, etc., rolling into sort of the more allegorical monsters that are based on those. And then eventually, what do you think about something like Hannibal Lecter? Hannibal Lecter, is he a monster or is he something else, some other category of villain, antagonist, something else?
Yeah. I think he's a monster. It takes a lot of things to be a monster, but just having a predisposal to looking terrifying is not necessarily the only requirement.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. So actually here, let's step back. Let's think. Let's just get a list of other monsters. And if we have just a list of monsters, then we can start to see, like, even if it's just a gut feeling of, yeah, this is a monster, no, this isn't a monster. Maybe that can help sort of map out the cosmos of monsterdom. So yeah, I would agree with you. Hannibal Lecter, monster.
Hitler,
monster. Dracula, monster. Vampire, monster, I think. Both Dracula
Frankenstein's
and
monster.
Frankenstein's monster. Ignoring the fact that, like, that is part of the thesis of the book, is like, maybe the monster isn't the monster, isn't actually a monster all along, but on its surface, face value, there is monsterdom that needs to be explored in Frankenstein.
Yeah.
As a side note, did you see the tweet that was going around from some right-wing bullshitter this week that was talking about, like, oh, now kids are saying that they have sympathy for Frankenstein's monster, saying that he might not actually be the monster and Victor Frankenstein could be the real one. And I'm like, every single ninth grader that has read Frankenstein came to that conclusion, because that is the point of the book.
Yup.
Let's see, who else?
So there's also the concept of a monster being a amalgamation. Maybe this is just getting into like racism of crossbreeding scenarios, right?
Maybe this is just getting into racism. Always a fun sentence that can only go good places. Continue.
Yeah, but I mean, in that sense of like a wolf isn't a monster, a human isn't a monster, but a werewolf is a monster, right? Or one of the reasons why Frankenstein's monster is a monster is because he's stitched together of a whole lot of different pieces. Or the reason why a zombie is a monster is because they have pieces taken out of them.
That has reminded me of back when I took a horror film study class freshman year of college, where we talked about Freud's concept of the uncanny, which I'm Googling now to try and make sure I accurately remember what it is, but gets at that idea of things that are... in that middle ground of familiar but foreign and alien at the same time, as opposed to something that is just purely a mystery, purely unknowable, cosmic horror, can't understand it, versus the thing that is 100% familiar and makes perfect sense. And so, yeah, maybe that is an element of monsterdom, is living in this uncanniness of having mixing that humanity with that other.
Yeah.
I mean, Hannibal Lecter, I think that's also a thing of, like, he looks like and acts like the perfect, cultured, brilliant doctor that, you know, listens to classical music and paints beautiful works of art, and also kills and eats people in the most gruesome, horrific way possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Monsters, man.
Monsters.
This is not my wheelhouse.
Yeah, you need to watch more horror movies, Doc. Yeah, so I guess I'm trying to think about, like, horror movies that have monsters versus horror movies that have villains. And maybe also movies in general that have monsters versus movies that have villains. I do think that there's a difference. I'd call Darth Vader one of the greatest villains in film, but I wouldn't call him a monster. Whereas Michael Myers from Halloween, I would 100% call a monster.
Yeah.
Or Jason Voorhees or Freddy Krueger.
Absolutely. But there's a fascinating concept of monsters, like a goal. There is usually a lack of goal. Usually it's just like to terrorize. So Freddy Krueger, his goal is to kill people because it feels good to kill. That's it.
Well,
that's all.
Also because he's getting revenge for the fact that the kids he's killing are the kids of the parents that killed him 20 years earlier.
Yes. But, yeah. Sure. You're right. But once he's done, like, what is there more to it? What is his life purpose?
And actually, I will also say, I'm thinking about, like, I guess spoilers for Friday the 13th. But in the first Friday the 13th movie, stalked by this hockey mask wearing killer, and at the end it's revealed that it's the mom of Jason Voorhees who is getting revenge for her son dying at this camp 13 years earlier or whatever. And to me, there's almost a moment where the monstrousness leaves once the motivation and the understanding is revealed, that when it's like this faceless, getting at what you're talking about, when it's this faceless masked killer that's killing for reasons unknown, though we can speculate.
Yeah.
It's an unstoppable force of nature. It's a monster. Once it becomes his mom that's doing it, it's still monstrous because it belies, like, it's insane of her to be attacking these kids that had nothing to do with her son's death several years later just because, you know, she wants to. So, like, there's still that break in logic that is kind of monstrous, but there is a logic there and there is a motivation and there is a goal, just like you said.
It's at the inception of a monster that you start to think about how this monster comes into being. Like, it starts off as this crazy something, whatever it is. Uh-huh. And then I think as it evolves, like, you start to understand it more, it becomes less and less monstrous. Mm-hmm. Like, if you totally understand something, and you understand the motivation and the reasons why they're doing it, they may be wrong, but it gets to a point where it's like, okay, I can still blame you for what you're doing, but you're less of a monster because I understand what it is you're doing.
And that I think even on top of that, they become more understandable. I think they also become more vulnerable and more able to be beaten. It's a trope at this point, but, like, especially in slasher movies or horror movies, stuff like that, a key part of it is we have to figure out this person's backstory so that we can understand what's the thing that's going to stop them. I think that, usually you learn who the person is right before they're finally able to be killed. And that becomes a part of both the audience and the protagonist. By understanding the person, they demonsterify them and therefore are able to finally take power and survive.
Kind of just quick tangent of my favorite book, Ender's Game. There's a moment in there when Ender is talking about how he defeats his enemies, and the moment before he defeats them, he loves them. Mm-hmm. He understands them completely and he loves them. And then he destroys them, and not, he doesn't, like, beat them in the battle. He, like, crushes them into a ground, fine dust. Is how he describes it, and it's a very accurate description. And he credits that the only reason why he can actually do that is because he loves them, because he's learned what makes them who they are. He learns everything about them, and that's love.
Damn.
It's a scary book.
Yeah.
Once you realize the concept, what Ender is, like, that's also, by the way, Ender, throughout the entire book, he's this sweet little boy who is just doing what's best for him. And at the end of it, he purposefully goes out into the world and makes himself into a villain, and says, and like centuries later, he's known as like Ender the Destroyer. Mm-hmm. And he could not be more proud. Not proud is not the right word. Proud of humanity for portraying him as such, like for this monstrous act that he did, that he knew that he did. And even though he knows that if these people understood him, that if they saw what he went through, if they read Ender's Game, to be frank, that they wouldn't see him as this demon monster. They would see him as this, you know, child who was manipulated by government.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. And I think that, exactly, it sort of takes that same script that is, all right, Sydney Prescott in Scream, once she figures out who the mass killers are, that's the moment when she's able to defeat them, and understands their motivations, then she can defeat them. So she demonstrifies the monsters and can win. Ender in becomes a monster by removing that from the narrative, that understanding of him, that understanding of his motivations, that understanding of his complexity. He becomes distilled into a monster in the way that people are seeing him.
Yeah.
So interesting. So I guess if we think back on some of the stuff that we've talked about, it has to be some sort of threat, some sort of danger. They have to be like, you're not a monster if you're just doing good things based on whatever the framing device that you're using or perspective of the character is. You gotta be doing some bad shit. You probably look weird, or at the very least you are in this sort of uncanny area where there's a mix of normalcy and other. And you have to be doing things for reasons that are unknowable. There can't be this like understanding of your motivation, understanding of your how everything works. I guess, yeah, similar, going back to that idea of like a wolf is not a monster if it's just hungry or protecting its litter or doing stuff like that. A wolf can become a monster if it's just this like thing that will hunt you forever with no rationale.
Yeah.
So where I'm going with this is thinking, all right, we briefly touched on it earlier. Frankenstein's monster. Is he a monster or not?
Considering that I'm watching Penny Dreadful right now, who has Frankenstein as a character, and he, I guess this is posed for a Penny Dreadful of he created two monsters in the show. At the start of the show, he creates one, and it's like this young, it's like a baby basically of learning how to exist in the world, and it's like full of joy and hope. And then the second monster gets introduced into the story by, it's like literally an episode after you learn about the first one. He like hands come out of his chest and he gets ripped apart as you meet his older creation that he originally created, who was an abomination basically, who scared Frankenstein shitless, and like Frankenstein just ran from him. And this is kind of what turned that character into a monster, was this abandonment issues. Why do I bring up these two things besides the fact that they're related to Frankenstein? They're kind of two different stories of like, one was kind of turned into a monster because of the way how he was treated, versus the other was attempted to like be bred into a, bred is not raised into a higher elevated, like new race of people, that was elegant and, you know, sweet and joyful. So I haven't actually read Frankenstein, but given the context of what I know from the show, he can be a monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in terms of the context of the book, that second, or I guess that first earlier monster, the monstrous monster, is basically especially in that episode, I think it's a couple episodes later, or maybe the episode right after that, where they go through his backstory of like, here's what happened after you built me and stuff like that. The actual beats are different, but it's this overarching structure of what happens to Frankenstein's monster in the book of, you know, goes off. I think in the book it's that he finds like a blind family out in like the Swiss, by a lake by Geneva or whatever. But they're, you know, a blind family. And so he's raised by them and they can't tell that he's a monster. Then once they discover maybe someone else comes to town or they feel his face or whatever, they're like, oh no, you're a monster. Bad. Go away. And then runs off. Versus I think in the show, it's like he works at the Grand Guignol or something like that. But I think, if I think about Frankenstein's monster and the monstrosity of it, one thing is for sure is that other people see him as a monster and that they take a look at him and they do all the things that we do to monsters in stories of assume that he is a, you know, he's this uncanny figure. So he's splitting that difference between human and not human. They assume that he does bad things or he may do things that seem bad. Like, I don't know, kill a cat or whatever, accidentally or do something like that. And they don't give him that interiority. They assume that he's a monster acting with no discernible motivation other than malice. And so he's 100% seen as a monster. And I think maybe that's kind of the story of Frankenstein is if everyone sees you as a monster, does that turn you into one? Or can you escape from that? And it seems like, I think the book is ambivalent on that front, though it's been probably 7-8 years since I've read it. But I seem to remember, like, based on the ending, it sort of kinda, you do some pretty bad things, but you still are, you're doing bad things with a motivation, even if your motivation is to try and live up to the image that people see you as.
Yeah. It's what the world made you kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's sad.
It is.
I don't know. Monsters, man.
Monsters, man. That was good.
I don't know. Any other thoughts?
Thoughts on monsters? Let's see. Horror movies are good. People should watch horror movies. They're fun. This is probably a little bit outside of the scope of this if what we're talking about is what makes a monster, but I think maybe a takeaway from this is that, like, key to something being monstrous is us simplifying it and sort of removing the complexity from something. And it's easy to see the ways in which that can be really helpful for storytelling. Cause like, oh cool, you have this just embodiment of evil,
hatred,
and of monstrousness and hatred. And and that's awesome. It's also very easy to see the way that like that can be very dangerous when applied to the real world, to think about things in like monstrous terms. When in reality, hey, guess what? Pretty much every person, has more humanity than just calling them a monster gives them. Tread lightly with thinking about things in monstrous terms in the real world. But damn, can it make for some fun movies?
Oh, yeah.
Cool. All right. If that's all that we've got, then I guess now is the time to say, if you have any thoughts on monsters or if you have thoughts on any of our earlier episodes, talking about simulations, talking about, YouTube and what, and Star Wars and time travel, you can always email us at theawclub@gmail.com. That's theawclub. We have not gotten any emails except for this one that I did find in our spam folder from xhardx@centrum.cz. It is from a Mrs. Deborah Paul, whose husband deposited £8.2 million with a bank when he was alive. And she is unfortunately suffering from esophageal cancer, probably metastasophageal cancer, but who knows? And her last wish is to see her money distributed to charity organizations anywhere in the world, because relatives and friends have plundered so much of my wealth since my illness. And so you can email to her personal email at something@yahoo.com. We're not going to give that away because like we got to get this money for ourselves.
No, we're donating that to charity. Her late husband died. We got to like cherish her wishes, man.
Now, here's what I would say is that £8.2 million going to us means that we can never have to work again and exclusively work on making great podcasts. And really, isn't that the real charity?
That's the best charity of all.
The real charity. But if you want to give us £8.2 million, theawclub@gmail.com or on Twitter at @theawclub. You can also, is it finally time that we tell people to find us on iTunes and subscribe and give us 5 stars and tell all their friends about this? Or do we want to?
Sure. Is that a thing? Yeah.
Ostensibly, theoretically, that does shit for the algorithm. Any plugs, Alex Wade? Anywhere to find you on the internet?
Not yet. Maybe someday soon.
I do have a plug this week, which is really fun. Last week, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, I was on the Taylor Swift podcast, Holy Swift, talking about the song Forever and Always. You go to Holy Swift Podcast, I think it's holyswiftpodcast.com, and check out, which episode was it? Let me look it up. Episode 64, Forever and Always, with Andrew Whipple. We talked about Taylor Swift, we talked about Gossip Girl, we talked about promise rings for probably more than we should have, and it was a great time.
Oh boy. Good job.
But yeah, listen to our podcast, email us, rate, subscribe, review, tell your friends, and I think that is it.
A-Dub Club out.
A-Dub Club out.